Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
So if you're a fan of New York writing, you have no doubt come across my next guest's words somewhere. You may know him best for his novel, Snow in August, or his memoir, A Drinking Life. Pete Hamill is also the author of a total of 19 books, many of them novels set in the city. And, of course, in his long career at New York newspapers, his tabloid columns told the real-life stories of the people who he says define the city. He has reported from Vietnam, Nicaragua, and Northern Ireland, among other places. He's also written essays on the state of journalism at the turn of the 21st century, and he knows a thing or two about that. He's the only person, as far as we know, to have edited both the New York Post and the Daily News. So author and newspaperman Pete Hamill is back with us now. His new novel, North River, is published today, and it centers on mostly immigrant life in 1930s New York. Hi, Pete. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning.
You know where I want to start? In your novel, one of the main characters is an Italian immigrant who learns to speak English partly from reading the Daily News. That happens in real life.
With a dictionary by her side. And then
maybe
using
that doesn't happen.
The new words she uses for two or three days over and over again until she gets them down, right? I think a lot of people did that. I think the tabloids in general, because it was before television. They couldn't sit and listen to the spoken word all day long with television. So they got it from radio, glimpses in the movies, but also those newspapers, which my father, who was an immigrant from Northern Ireland, really became an American reading the sports pages of the Daily News. Not de Tocqueville, not the Federalist Papers.
Right.
Reading Dick Young and the other guys who wrote baseball.
And do you think that the newspapers, that the management of the newspapers were aware of that at any time?
In those days, they were. I mean, it started with Pulitzer, Joseph Pulitzer, who himself was an immigrant. And when he took over the world right across the square from where we're sitting.
That's the newspaper called The World,
yeah.
As opposed to Rupert Murdoch, who just wants to take over the world.
The English-speaking world, anyway.
Plus China.
But Pulitzer, who was a Hungarian Jew, said, we must cover this immigrant wave. Even if the people don't read the paper, the kids will. And it was amazing. He knew one, it was a great story, the transformation of a culture, really.
And so many people.
Yeah, and so many people. You know, 2 million. This is today we have the biggest immigration wave since then. And I don't think we're doing a particularly great job covering it.
How not? What should they be doing?
Well, I think they have to be out there and tell those stories better about the people who are here, their American children, of this figure of 12 million that they use all the time, which nobody is counting. They estimate there's 3.5 million American children who are as good as I am or you are or Bush is or Tom Tancredo. Those are our American kids, and we have to think through this business. Do we really want to deport their parents and leave them to the tender mercies of foster care or something?
Right. But that's the policy issue. When I think about newspaper columnists, it seems to me that there's a lost generation, that the entire art has changed, that there were people like you and Jimmy Breslin, Murray Kempton, and others who were really going out to neighborhood bars and this place, that, writing about individuals or writing about policy through the stories of individuals. Now, there are lots of policy columnists today and some very good ones, even, you know, in the present-day New York tabloids, but I don't think there's the same emphasis on the individual story and very much the individual immigrant story. Do you think?
I agree with you. I think one of it is one reason for it is the overdependence on the internet. In other words, to sit in the building and call up all the various statements from politician X or Y or Z or or think tank A, B, or C is not the same as going to 116th Street and seeing the changeover from Puerto Rican culture to Mexican culture, for example. In fact, and what it teaches us, what it tells us.
Yeah. In fact, the Daily News recently, as you probably know, laid off a number of columnists, and they now have a stripe along the right hand of the editorial page or op-ed page that has little one-paragraph takes of what people are writing on their websites.
Yeah, blogging, you know, the blogosphere. And I, when I teach at NYU, I try to tell these young potential journalists, don't waste your time with blogs, because you need to be somewhere where there are editors, where you're getting paid. The blog might be useful therapy, but it's not, at this stage of its development, journalism. And I think that is a big mistake to be doing that kind of stuff.
Pete Hamill, my guest on WNYC, his new novel is called North River. And in North River, the main character is a charitable doctor. And you write in stark detail about the dire health conditions that city dwellers endured during the Depression, the fatal diseases like pneumonia and TB. TB is suddenly hip again for journalists because of this guy, Speaker. But at the time, they were really the scourge of the poor. People would sooner die at home than risk going to the hospital, in your telling.
Yeah.
That was the case?
Yeah, and that's what the research told me, and you can't print your research in a novel. It's not an essay. It's an act of the imagination. But the big problem in the 30s was that the doctors were ahead of the scientists. In other words, my doctor, like many doctors, knew what the problem was, knew it was tuberculosis or gonorrhea or whatever it was. There was no cure. And that's where the image of the bedside manner came in, because they were trying to at least console people and get them through a terrible time in their lives, waiting for the science to develop. It's before penicillin, before sulfa drugs, before all the things that came in the 40s, and these people had nothing. But you still had, as a doctor or anybody in the sort of caring industry, had to convince people that they should maintain hope. And I think that was the noblest thing they did. It didn't. They weren't there to get rich. Nobody got rich. It was $2 for an office visit and $3 for a house call. And if you didn't have the money, you didn't pay.
Don't you have a scene in this book where the doctor throws aside some of the science magazines, kind of in frustration?
Yes, exactly for that. It was a way to dramatize the frustration about the lack of progress in science, the science side of medicine, leaving it in the hands of these doctors and nurses to try to help hurt people get through things in a climate of general economic hurt. People were trying to get through this thing, and they did. And they did it by being tough in the best sense, not mean. And like all tough people I've ever met, they didn't talk tough. They were tough. And that combination of people, particularly in this town, were the people that got us to 1945. Because when the war ended, a 15-year period ended, Brian, of combination of depression and the war, a period of austerity, of self-denial.
Which is why one of the main reasons that Tom Brokaw labeled the people who lived through that the greatest generation, just because they had to face all of that economic adversity and then all of that military adversity,
right,
and came through it all with flying colors.
Yeah, and absolutely. And you can't praise them enough. I agree so much with Brokaw's theory, at least in my experience. I was born in 1935, a year after the time of this novel. But that generation shaped me. I'm the inheritor. I and a lot of people my age inherited the values that those people forged in adversity. Self-pity is not allowed. You know, that was the cardinal sin. You might end up renting a gun and sticking up a grocery store to get food for your kids, But self-pity, you couldn't do that. And I think that those were admirable values that were passed on to at least the next generation.
I think this is a good spot for you to read from the book, because I think the passage that you picked out actually relates to this idea a bit. My guest is Pete Hamill. His new novel is called North River. And do you want to set this up or just dive in?
Sure. The doctor is a neighborhood doctor. His father had been a Tammany Hall guy who died in the influenza epidemic in 1918, along with 29,000 other New Yorkers. He lives way over on the west side of the village, Horatio Street. And he questions all the time, why don't I leave? Why don't I just leave? I can't help these people truly in the darkest parts of the night. And yet he won't. He feels an obligation. He's one of them. And he feels like he must stay with them. So this is a rumination at night. This wasn't just a neighborhood. Delaney knew that it was a point of view, a way of looking at the world and living in it. They all believed in the unions, the longshoremen, the teamsters, the carpenters, the steam fitters, and so did their wives. Even out of work, the men were out of work as union men. In the 20s, more than a few of them had had their heads cracked in fights on picket lines. Men like Paddy Rafferty, who sat now with vacant eyes in the Doc Walloper's union hall. Some had cracked a few heads themselves, but they got the union forever. They had voted for Roosevelt and said so, and some had voted for LaGuardia and didn't say so, because they had never voted for a Republican in their lives. Now some of them were communists, vehement and certain, but Delaney was sure that wouldn't last. The communists did not easily forgive sin. On the West Side, sin and its forgiveness were part of the deal. That's why he'd come back here. That's why he'd return to make a second life with Molly, that's his wife, and Grace, his daughter, after the war had destroyed so many things, including the certainties of that first life. These were his people. They needed him. They still did. And he needed them. They would fight if threatened, and he would fight for them and with them. He would try to prolong their lives or save them. He would help them move their children through the ceaseless dangers of the streets. He would try as hard as he could to ease their pain, to bring them sleep, to give them another day, another week, another year. The reason was simple. Here, all sins were forgiven, even the sins of James Finbar Delaney.
Pete Hamill reading from his new book, North River. If you want to hear him read some more, he'll be doing a reading and book signing tonight at 7 o'clock at the Barnes & Noble at Union Square. So that's tonight. If you want to talk to Pete Hamill now about the themes of North River or anything about journalism from his days working for the Daily News mostly and the New York Post a little bit, or some of the other journalistic things that he's done, or anything else that's coming up in this conversation, give us a call for Pete Hamill, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or email brianlehrershow@wnyc.org. Did you write this book really to tell a story of that time, or are you trying to relate it to somehow conditions today because it's going to have some contemporary resonance?
Yeah, it's both, Brian. In other words, I wanted to deal with a veteran of World War I, and how wars, no matter where they're fought and how they're fought, because they're fought by young men, leave scars that last forever. That doesn't mean they leave resentment or other kinds of emotional things, but the scars are there. So I wanted that in the book. But most of all, I wanted to celebrate that generation. I wanted to say it's the generation of my mother and father and millions of other people who came here from elsewhere and changed the city for the better, put, you know, steel into our alloy, and who went through terrible times without giving up. They didn't they might not believe in tomorrow, but the day after tomorrow was a possibility. I wanted to celebrate that and to take the risk of being accused of sentimentality, because it always comes up when you're an Irish American. You know, if you think someone's a decent person, it's sentimentality, because we all know everybody is miserable and nasty. So I wanted to write that sort of book. And also it came, one final thing, Brian, it came from the aftermath of September 11th, where there was so much talk about heroes. And granted, guys that ran into burning buildings are heroes, but so are a lot of other people, teachers, doctors, nurses, you know, who do a quiet kind of heroism against tremendous odds, and I wanted to celebrate them, too.
Anne in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Pete Hamill. Good morning, Anne.
Hi, Mr. Hamill. Hi, Mr. Lehrer. I'm from the Midwest. My mother was a Irish pioneer in Montana, and my father was a farmer in Minnesota, and I agree that this is really the kind of, these are the kind of people that we came from, and especially referring to 9/11, I wondered why there is so little courage in especially the media as far as talking about 9/11, the truth about what's happened.
Uh-oh.
When we have had all of our liberties taken and we're at war and people are dying, and it's so obvious it was controlled demolition.
Controlled demolition. Well, there are people out there who think the World Trade Center was controlled demolition.
Well, I think the theories like controlled demolition are the instinct people have, understandably, to deal with enormous horrors, that there has to be an explanation. It's why people write fiction, to try to get at it. I don't think it's dishonorable or anything, but no matter what the cause was, we have to get over it and deal with it and have this world not have us turn into the kinds of people we're supposedly fighting. And so I think the fight against torture and Guantanamo and all kinds of things must go on. And I think we'll leave the causes to historians.
And you don't have to even believe in the theory that the U.S. government destroyed the World Trade Center in order to raise the civil liberties questions, obviously.
Yes, exactly.
Bob in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Yes, hi. Thank you. You put immigrants and bars together, and I have to relate an incident that it just shows that some things don't change. When I was growing up, I grew up in a Polish community, and there were social clubs with names like Polish Nationalized American Citizens Club. And I grew up around them, and that's the way they supported each other. And about 2 years ago, I'm walking across 125th Street, and I walked by a storefront, and I wasn't even looking up, and I got the smell, the stale beer and the cigarettes. And I look up, and there's a sign that says, Guatemalan American Citizens Club. And I turned around, I walked back down, and I looked in, and sure enough, you know, there are the guys, you know. And there was even a little kid hanging around the place like I used to.
The more things change.
Yeah, it was amazing.
Exactly.
And they probably once said your people were unassimilable, too.
Yeah.
Yes.
They did.
Yes, yes, yes.
Thank you, Bob. We'll continue in a minute with Pete Hamill and ask him if he still believes that no one has ever written the great New York novel. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with the great novelist and New York newspaper man Pete Hamill. His new novel is called North River, set in New York in the 1930s. You know what we might do, Pete, for some callers? I'm curious to hearken back to what we started with at the beginning of the hour. I wonder if there are people out there for whom the newspapers, and I guess particularly the tabloids like the Daily News and the New York Post, but any newspaper, have newspapers been a part of your acculturation process? Have newspapers helped you or your parents or your children to learn English? Does the kind of thing that Pete writes about a bit in this novel from the 1930s go on today in immigrant New York? Call up with your experiences, the place of the New York newspapers in the role of in the lives of your immigrant family. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And anything else you want to say or ask to Pete Hamill. By the way, you look great. You are, I realized from what you said earlier, you're 73 years old now.
72.
72 with a birthday.
June 24th.
Okay. 72 point a lot. And you just look fabulous. Now, you split your time. We have a picture of you on our website, too, that's a current picture, and people could see how good you look. You split your time between New York and somewhere in Mexico. Where do you live?
Yeah, Cuernavaca, which is where Malcolm Lowry lost it in the 1930s. Zapata town.
How much time here? How much time there?
Well, last year, because there's construction work going on our building, in order to write this book, I was in Mexico 7 months. You know, not continuously, but over the course of the year. And I went there on the GI Bill 50 years ago, so I'm familiar with it. I don't feel an urge to write about it in order to understand it.
What do you mean on the GI Bill? You went to Mexico?
Yeah, I went to Mexico on the GI Bill to a place called Mexico City College, where William Burroughs went, and I think Kerouac was there for a quarter, and it was full of GIs and girls from Ohio State for a junior year in Mexico. And you'd be in the same room with these little girls, young girls, forgive the use of girls, but that's what they were. And guys who had been in the Battle of the Bulge. It couldn't have been a better student body.
You worked as a sheet metal worker at the Brooklyn Navy Yard. You served in the Navy, and then you trained as a graphic designer. And somehow you somehow you ended up in journalism.
Yeah, I wrote a letter to the editor of the Post, who was a fellow named James Wexler. And it was the last part of the time when you didn't need credentials, or else I could never have been hired. And he sent me a letter back saying, have you ever thought about becoming a newspaper man? And I had, since I saw Roman Holiday with Gregory Peck, and he was living in Rome, and he never seemed to work, and he had Audrey Hepburn. I said, boy, what a life
that is.
That's
a life. I want to do that.
I wonder if I could do that. It was total accident, total amazing good luck. And it turned out I never worked much with Wexler because he worked days and I worked nights, but it was my true graduate school.
Simon in Queens. You're on WNYC with Pete Hamill. Hi, Simon.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
You're exactly talking, you remind me, forgive me first of all for my English, and you remind me the time when I come to this country.
How did you use the newspaper?
Yes, and I was working for a Russian boss. And one old American guy said, you very knowledgeable, you know your job. If you want to reach something here, you have to lose. I got excited. And you have to forget a Russian newspaper because he's in a Russian newspaper.
So which New York?
You forget a Russian boss.
Which New York newspaper did you start reading first?
New York Post, and I'm reading up to today. And I come here without any word English. And cool. Thank God I can communicate, I can little write, I can read a little read. I'm okay.
Simon, thank
you. You're communicating perfectly.
That's right.
No, it's too far from being good, but, you know, I come not a young man, and I have a family behind me. It means I have to support. I don't have a chance to go to school. I work hard. Thank God.
Thank you, Simon.
Thanks for coming.
Good luck. Helen in Oceanside, you're on WNYC. Hi, Helen.
I'm about the same age as Pete Hamill, and young. I love his books. I've read his books. I love his books. And my father came out from Ireland in 1927, and I remember him talking about when he'd get on the subway. He and my uncle, who was also from County Donegal, would sit in the subway reading the Daily News. And that was how they learned how to read. They never went to school in Ireland. He said by the time he was age 11, he had to go out and work in the quarry. And it's just amazing to me how, you know, they didn't have an education. And eventually my father became a plumber. He was in the plumbers union. And they worked hard.
They
he was
sure
a hard
did.
Worker. He,
all of that generation.
They did. They were hard workers. I think people like that are gone. And I think they threw away the mold.
But you don't think so, Pete, do you?
No, I think just to name one or two minorities in New York, immigrant minorities, the Mexicans and the Chinese, they work and they work and they work. Their numbers on welfare are virtually non-existent.
Uh-huh.
Their numbers in the jails are virtually non-existent. Well, they didn't come here to sit on the stoop. They came to work. So there's days when I see some Mexican woman hurrying off to clean someone else's apartment. I think, she's my mother.
Yeah.
I look at a guy throwing garbage into a garbage truck on 2nd Avenue at 3 o'clock in the morning. I think, that's my father.
Yeah.
That's what they came here for.
Yeah, well,
and every promise that the country gave to them was kept.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that if you worked hard, you know, and you played by the rules, your kids were going to finish universities or be taller than you under any circumstances.
Right.
And those promises were kept. We should be proud of those immigrants and the continuing tradition.
And, you know, back in those days, there was no no help for them. There was no...
No. Well, they did. There was one, ma'am, if I can disagree just a little.
Yes.
It was called Tammany Hall.
Oh, okay.
And one of the things that we're missing now with this big immigration wave is some political instrument that can be a buffer between the state mm-hmm. and the people. And the Tammany Hall did that. For all its corruption and and so on, they also help people become Americans.
Right.
Helen, thank you very much.
Well, I'm very happy that I got to talk to Pete Hamill.
Well, thanks for calling.
Made my day.
Thanks
right,
for calling.
Bye-bye now.
The Tammany Hall machines also got their votes.
Yeah, of course. Of course. Why not? They helped your brother-in-law get a job, then, you know, we'll vote for you for the rest of your life.
I was thinking just the other day, I was walking on Fordham Road in the Bronx, and there was this guy with a little stand cutting up mangoes, right? So
right.
You take the fresh mangoes, peel them, cut them up into slices, and put them in a little plastic thing, and people would come and buy them for $2. I bought a tin, a plastic container, and I'm thinking, this guy, I tried to strike up a conversation with him, but there wasn't much English there. And I'm thinking, this guy is like my own grandfather, who came as an immigrant and worked in a fish store in the Bronx and raised my mother. And, you know, and I'm thinking, well, my grandfather would not have been allowed in under the new point system that they were considering for the immigration law.
Yeah.
And so, I don't know, I just related it to that guy.
Yeah. Well, try to cut a mango up, too. That's
not easy. Not easy. He had a very sharp, a small, very sharp knife. Your writing has appeared on the pages of both the Daily News and The New Yorker. I don't know how many people can say that. They're very different publications. Do you feel like you're somebody who kind of walks that line between, you know, higher brow and lower brow, if you don't mind using those terms?
Well, I always thought right from the beginning when I became a reporter that there was a lot to be learned from popular culture, from anybody's popular culture. And so I was interested in comic strips and Raymond Chandler and all kinds of other movies and all that. But I had editors at the Post when I broke in who made it clear, the audience is not stupid. Do not write down to them. And I think having those kind of editors shaped whatever became my style, because I didn't have one when I showed up. And it informed the rest of my career. And I think every young person who wants to be a journalist should remember that. Don't write down to the audience because they'll know that you're doing it.
Doris in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Doris.
Hi. I thought my story was interesting. My father came from Lithuania, and he learned English by reading the New York Times. As a result,
he took the hard route.
Yeah, no. Well, that's he wants to go to the best with anything.
No offense, Pete.
And as a result, he knew sophisticated words. But if people spoke to him in ordinary slang, or sometimes just, you know, the common speak, he didn't know what they were talking about.
That's funny.
Those words.
Now, one of the problems with the tabloids is they're in love with puns, And so for immigrants, this is very hard. They don't know the original source of the cliché that's being punned upon. And today's papers show it. Sopranos whack fans or something. That might be a little tough. And they don't know other things. They don't. The immigrants don't know what a box score is, you know, and most Americans barely can read them. So you have to, as an editor, be aware of that. You're talking to an audience that you can be very simple and clear and classical, and they'll get it, but not to play around too much.
Doris, thank you for your call. We're almost out of time. Your novel, North River, features a few mob figures as characters, and so I guess we would be remiss not to mention the number one tabloid story in New York today. And for listeners, here's a spoiler alert. If you TiVo'd The Sopranos last night, you might want to tune out for the next 3 minutes or so. But did you watch it?
I did, yeah, I did. And I like almost everybody I spoke to this morning on my way to buy the tabloids. I thought it was a cheat. You know, I thought they being Cooley in the news had it right, I think. It didn't end, it stopped. And there have been other movies like that. In an odd way, The French Connection, which is a much more satisfactory conclusion, also had an ambiguity in it where you didn't know quite what was happening. So it took some guts for David Chase to do it that way. But I think it means a feature film is on its way.
Maybe. That's certainly the cynical...
Otherwise, the theory of this whole thing is never order the fried onions.
The onion rings. The Sopranos, though, along the lines of what we've been talking about, it's a very humanizing show about mobsters.
Yeah.
Can you imagine a gang from a Jamaican mob family in Brooklyn or an Arab mob family in New Jersey ever being portrayed in that way with their therapists and their variously sympathetic relatives and all of that? I mean, it's only because we see the Italian mafia as somehow safe now, isn't it?
Well, I think you will see that when they get to the second generation. I don't think Meyer Lansky ever went to or Lepke Buchalter or Al Capone ever went to a therapist. But when it gets to second, third generations, certain things are possible. So who knows?
I have this quote from you. Tell me if it's accurate. You said, "No one has ever written the great novel about New York. The best novel in New York was The Daily News."
Yeah, I agree with that. And as someone who's written novels about New York, because it's too various and too layered and too huge, and the velocity of change is so unbelievably quick. You go away for the summer and you come back and your favorite coffee shop is a hole in the ground as they get ready to stick some other building in it.
60-story.
Yeah.
Luxury condos.
So what I've tried to do is to write about the period before television, where people got information from newspapers and radio and occasional movies, and books from the library. But not from television. And I think that was a more vivid period, certainly for me.
So set in the 1930s is Pete Hamill's new novel, North River. By the way, you just got to tell me, I know where the East River is. I know where the Hudson River is. I know where the Harlem River is. What's the North River?
The North River was the name that the Dutch gave to what became the Hudson. The South River was the Delaware. Their South River. And the East River was an estuary, so it didn't have any name at the time. And it lasted into the 1950s. You'd ask a guy where he's working, he says, Pier 41 North River, you know. And it was on the maps, and assignment editors at newspapers say, get up to Pier 56 North River, Jane Mansfield's going to sit on a trunk or something. And then it went out. It disappeared somewhere in the 50s.
The one remnant I can think of still is that they call the sewage treatment plant, the North River Sewage Treatment Plant, there around 135th Street.
That's right. And because the North River would go up to about where the Tappan Zee is now. So in the memory of some, it is still there.
When I was in fourth grade doing New York geography, the teacher asked one kid in the class in a pop oral quiz one day, what's the name of the river between Queens and Manhattan. And he said, the East River. She turned to me and she said, what's the name of the river between Manhattan and New Jersey? I had no clue. I said, the West River. I got a great laugh from my classmates, but somehow never forgot the humiliation. Okay, Pete Hamill's new book, North River, and he will be reading and signing books at the Union Square Barnes & Noble tonight at 7 o'clock. Always a great pleasure. Thank you
very
much.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, coming up in a minute. In fact, you can start calling right now if you want. A call-in for anyone who has served in the military during the Don't Ask, Don't Tell era. How does it really work? 212-433-WNYC.